Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
And here's where we must recognize something very important. We white patriots must never fall into the trap of accepting or using our enemy's definition of the word extremist, any more than we should accept our enemy's definition of the word racist. These words are enemy inventions, designed to put an end to all discussion, designed to intimidate people. And the moment we start to use them, and especially if we start to view their meanings as the enemy would have us view them, we're fighting the battle on the enemy's ground. We're fighting according to his rules. And we'll be fighting the battle on the enemy's ground and according to the enemy's rules once we start to imagine that we're going to win people over by softening our principles. People simply are not impressed by this. They detect phoniness. And I'm quite sure that the American people, like the British people, have had quite enough of phonies as political leaders. And if you want to operate as a phony, if you want to be a phony, I have news for you. George W. Bush and Tony Blair, they can do it far better than you can, far better than we can. If we try to play the game of being political phonies, they will beat us every time. But my experience back in Britain is that the phonies are on the way out. The phonies are more than ever discredited. What seriously worries mainstream journalists now in Britain, and it may be the case here too, what is sending them frantic is the fact that more and more people are staying away from the polling booths because they have complete contempt for all politicians. Tony Blair, the Conservatives, Bush, Kerry, complete contempt for politicians. So we're not going to score any points by playing at being phonies. People are looking for honest men and women at the head of national affairs. And we must give them those honest leaders. And that is what will make them come with us in the fullness of time. I mean, we must always remember another thing. The people that we're seeking to win over, the mass of the public, are a bit weaker than we are. Not weaker in every way. They include men with great war records, great service records. They include people of courage. But weaker in their political attitudes. This means that it's up to us to infuse them with our strength. Something of our strength. Our strength has to rub off on them as we speak to them. For that's the only way we're going to get them to come with us. If we radiate weakness by being anything less than 100% convinced of the rightness of our cause, totally unapologetic about the rightness of our cause, by presenting our ideas to people, if we present our ideas to people in a half-baked way, as if we're apologizing for them, our own uncertainty, our own weakness will communicate itself to the people we want to convert, and that will justify their weakness to themselves. We have to be, in a way, psychologists, and we have to try to get into the inner recesses of the minds of the people we're trying to win over. And that is, I think, a very important thing to bear in mind in that task. Anything we do that radiates weakness will vindicate them in their own cowardice, and nothing will be done. And that's why I oppose utterly the tactics of going to people and saying, really, we're not racists. That straight away is an admission that we recognize racism as wrong. And if we do that, we may as well run up the white flag. I never, never, never deny the charge of being a racist. I don't go about shouting that I'm a racist, because that's admitting the validity of a piece of the enemy's language. But I never run away from the charge of racism, and I recommend that neither should you. I think sometimes we tend to believe that all those people out there, the masses, they're full of these wimpy liberals that Sam Dixon spoke so brilliantly about earlier today. They're all like that. You know, they're frightened of people like us. Well, I've had one or two experiences which suggest the contrary. Two experiences I'm going to relate to you as quickly as I can. I was parliamentary candidate for the BNP in a by-election in Dagenham in 1994. Dagenham is a sort of suburban town on the eastern fringe of London. And I was a parliamentary candidate there, and I was going around canvassing, just like you have to do, going around speaking to as many of the local voters as I could. And I just left a house where I'd been speaking to the people there. I was crossing the road, and I saw a group of young construction workers doing a sort of road repair job. And I went up to them, and they looked, there are about four or five of them, they looked tough, good, tough, white, young men. The types you'd like to have with you in a trench in wartime, you know, when the shooting starts. And I said to them, I'm John Tyndall, the BNP candidate, I hope you'll vote for us, etc., etc. And voice comes from one of the workers, and here I must censor out one or two words, because this is a very respectable audience with lots of ladies here, and therefore I'll have to just censor out one or two words. I'm sure those of you who've been in the armed forces, or in prison for that matter, will know exactly what I mean. But this young chap, who seemed to be the leader of the group, the foreman, he said, "What are you going to do about a bleeding foreigners coming here?" So I said, we're going to organize a humane repatriation scheme, all very civilized, with expenses paid. We will pay them to go home, and we will pay to set them up in the... "Wait a minute, mate, that's much too expletive soft," he says. "Much too soft with the expletives. You know what I'd expletive do, mate? I'd get them all in a great big expletive boat. I'd sail the boat out to the middle of the ocean, and I would expletive well sink it. That's what I'd do." Now, of course, I had to assure him, and of course the others roared their approval of this. So I had to assure him, "No, we don't do things like that. You know, we're civilized people, and we would not do anything like that. You know, that I believe that my scheme that I've been presenting you is the right way to do it. I still hope you'll vote for me, because after all, I'm nearer to your way of thinking than any of the others are." "Okay, mate, we'll think about it." Now, anyway, there's an example of the fact, you know, a lot of the general public are a lot further along the way to extremism than we are. Now, another experience, I was fighting an election in the general election in Britain in 1992, and I was contesting a seat in East London, and the campaign was being organized by my campaign manager, agent, as we call them there, and he said, there's one local lady you must meet. She's a kind of matriarch in this street. If you get her on your side, you'll win the whole street. It could be, get her vote, it could be worth 200 more votes. So she's a very important lady. She has a lot of influence on the local community. So we went along to this lady's house. I was half expecting to see some sort of big domineering butch type, you know. But no, there's a very gentle, sweet old lady. She just looked as if she wouldn't harm a fly. And so I explained our policy to her on immigration and repatriation. And she said, in the way that London East Enders say, "Well, love," she said, "yeah, that's all very well, but you know what I think? I think we need someone like Hitler. That's what I think."
Welcome to Voice of Albion on the White Network. This is episode 3 of John Tyndall, The 11th Hour. Before I continue with The 11th Hour, I'd like to read an article in John Tyndall's Spearhead magazine, March 2000, entitled, "We Have Ways of Shutting You Up." John Tyndall: "Reading a Jewish chronicle is always instructive. Obtaining my copy in my local newsagents is slightly embarrassing. People of the faith are numerous in my neighbourhood, and when I step up to the counter to pay, there are often one or two of them queuing for the same purpose. As they observe what I am buying and then examine my person, I can just imagine them muttering to themselves, 'He doesn't look like one of us.' One gentleman, with a rather rabbinical appearance, once made so bold as to ask, with doubt in his eyes, 'Are you Jewish?' I replied negatively, of course. It then occurred to me to add, mischievously, 'I just believe in keeping an eye on them.' I could see the man's face crease into a frown, so thinking, 'In for a penny, in for a pound,' I went on to say, 'You know, this is where you get a lot of the real news, the sort you don't read in the ordinary press.' I recalled that remark last month when wondering how the fraternity in question were going to react to the rise of Jörg Haider in Austria. Actually, I myself have some reservations about Haider. Anyone who looks so like Tony Blair has to be treated with a certain amount of circumspection. Also, Haider has been making a number of apologies lately, for instance for daring once to say something complimentary about Hitler's employment policies. Well, what's wrong with that? Whatever may be said against the Führer in other respects, the fact is that he did put 6 million jobless Germans back to work in very quick time. I believe anyway that politicians are almost always wrong to apologise, and Herr Haider did not go up in my estimation on that account. But of course, it is always the perception of what a politician is, rather than the reality, that determines attitudes towards him. Haider is perceived, rightly or wrongly, as some kind of neo-Nazi monster, hence my curiosity. The way Haider's success was greeted in the Jewish Chronicle was of great interest to me, but more because of what it told me about the writers in that paper and their attitudes than what was said about Haider himself. The Jewish Chronicle was in a not unaccustomed dilemma. The paper, of course, stands for the loftiest principles of democracy, in quotes, but has not Haider risen to his present powerful position in Austrian politics by the democratic vote of the people? You see the problem. The Jewish Chronicle leader, 4 February, spoke first about the very rapid manner in which the other member states of the European Union reached agreement as to what their response was to be the prospect of Haider party having places in the Austrian government. They served notice, it said, that any role for Mr. Haider's party would prompt them drastically to downgrade ties with Austria. This would, amongst other things, involve shelving bilateral exchanges with the Austrians, curtailing political contacts with Austrian envoys in EU states, and refusing to back Austrian candidates for posts in international organisations. To which the ordinary rational person would no doubt react by saying, "So what?" It is doubtful that great numbers of Austrians will be applying at their chemist shops for additional sleeping tablets on those accounts, but we should read a little further. Generally approving this Europe-wide reaction, the Jewish Chronicle also admitted its snags, acknowledging that it might make Mr. Haider yet more popular at home. Yet the leader continued, "This does not mean the outside world should abruptly change course, abandon its position of principle, and take a softly-softly approach. It does mean that the underlying principle must be patently, publicly, and articulately explained. The aim, it must be made clear, is not to seek to exclude Austria and its people from the EU or the world family of nations, nor to question the right of voters to choose who governs them. It is to define bedrock tenets with which the world community hopes to build a 21st century on lessons learnt from the bigotry and murder that too often mark the 20th. To the extent Austria chooses to include in its government a party rooted in an opposing vision of both the past and the future, to continue business as usual would be illogical and immoral. You have to be something of a Jewish Chronicle watcher, which I might extend by saying a watcher of the entire liberal New World Order orientated press, to see the not immediately clear message here. It lies in the last two lines, and the operative word is business. This, I suspect, means much more than just business in the diplomatic sphere, cross-border contacts, appointments to international offices, etc. It looks very much as if it could mean actual trade and commerce. Is the Jewish Chronicle leader giving the first hints of a planned economic boycott? To get a clue as to the answer to that question, we might turn to an article on page 31 of the same issue by John Diamond, who was much more explicit. Mr. Diamond, of course, believes too in a democratic freedoms. Well, almost, but not quite. There is, you see, democracy and democracy. It all depends for whom. He begins by saying, a fully paid-up member of the Freedom of Speech Brigade. He continues, I spent my formative political years telling anyone who would listen that it was Voltaire who cracked the one about disagreeing with what you say but defending to the death your right to say it. But he goes on, then come along Little Austria, a paid-up member of the European Union, and announces that its equivalent of the Conservative Party is in an uncomfortable colloquy with its ultra-right-wing Freedom Party, with the result that any day now the erstwhile annex to the Fatherland might once again have and its cross-state in government, Nazis in government. Okay, they're not National Socialists in the scientific sense, perhaps, but when you have a party which talks about Aryans, immigrants and bloodied soul in the way some in the Freedom Party do, it's hardly worth splitting hairs. By now, Mr. Diamond is clearly anticipating some people disagreeing with his drift. He has prepared for that. He has an answer. But hold on, said the other side, what about democracy? If Jörg Haider's chums go into the government or even, God forbid, run the government, it will be as a result of the democratic will of the Austrian people. Equally, Austria was elected into the EU by what passes for democracy in that institution. We can't just kick them out because we don't like the people they elect to power. Now, Mr. Diamond is really in full flow, and the reader can almost predict what's coming next. He does not disappoint. It's perceived to be the same argument that we liberals use when we say that, much as we despise the British National Party, we regard its right to erect websites, hold bring and buy coffee mornings and publish maniacal brochures about how the Jews control the world as inviolable. It is not the same argument at all. Why isn't it? The reader will naturally begin to ask, but the reader obviously is not aware that people like Mr. Diamond make the rules in these matters, or at least that it is their presumption. Homosexuals, even paedophiles, may use the net. So may the spokesman for the IRA and other terrorist groups. You will not find the John Diamonds objecting to this. All sorts of organisations, in addition to this, may publish tracts claiming that such and such control the world. Catholics, Freemasons, Jehovah's Witnesses, and little green men from Mars. No problem. That's the freedom that Voltaire talked about, and Mr. Diamond stoutly defends it. As he said, he's a fully paid-up member of the Freedom of Speech Brigade. But when it comes to saying critical things about Mr. Diamond's own people, that's different. You see the point? Dealing with those Austrians. All this is building up to the most important thing that Mr. Diamond wants to say. He has obviously been wrestling in his mind with the questions of how to say it, because he is aware of its contradictions. He believes in democracy, as we have seen, but on the other hand, some democracy, for some people, just can't be allowed. So what are we to do about Austria and Haider? Mr. Diamond has the answer. Within the non-bellicose bounds of international diplomacy, we have a limited armoury with which to deal with a party led by a professed admirer of some of Hitler's policies. We have no right to stop Haider saying such things, but we can say, in effect, to Austria. Elect whatever government you choose. That's your prerogative. But equally, it's our prerogative to stop trading with you, going to your ski runs, sending you our ambassadors, or generally treating you like civilized people. It's your loss, and the practical loss will be greater than whatever gain you perceive there will be to sending in a few Turkish or East European immigrants home. Come back when you've decided to stop being silly. This is the way to deal with the nastier byproducts of free speech. It shouldn't, for instance, be necessary to pass laws to stop right-wing fanatics from saying that evil Jews are taking over the world. Simply make sure publishers know that. If they want to sell such nonsense to true believers, they'll have problems selling other books to the rest of us. Don't like a fascist website? There are plenty of suppliers of net facilities to the fascists who would lose out if the rest of us stopped using their services. Here, spelled out in as frank terms as we could wish for, is Mr. Diamond's idea of how democracy should work. It will be noted that nowhere does he suggest that the arguments of people he thinks are wrong should be countered in open and honest debate and proved by his superior argument to be fallacious. That, to most of us, is what democracy has meant across the ages. But to Mr. Diamond? Oh no. In the eyes of him and his ilk, it means something entirely different. To him and his ilk, democracy means the right to suppress the views of people you don't like by threats and intimidation, mainly economic intimidation. Boycott their industries for a start. In Austria, a big industry is tourism. Very well, let's not visit their ski slopes. Where does this lead? Shall we refuse to buy a recording made by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra? Shall we refuse even to listen to Mozart, Haydn, Schubert or Strauss? After all, Mr. Diamond has suggested that we should not treat the Austrians, out of whose ranks have come these immortal geniuses, like civilized people. And extending the issue beyond Austria, it is clear that Mr. Diamond believes that internet suppliers who hire facilities to those of those whose politics he disapproves should simply be closed down, not by an act of law, that would be too blatant, but by ruining them by boycott. Booksellers and publishers? Same treatment. Make sure hardly anyone buys their books and they'll fold up. Business is business. This then seems to be the ideal of democracy believed in by Mr. Diamond and many like him. Perhaps it's all part of the bedrock tenets with which the world community hopes to build the 21st century. We cannot say we haven't been told. On to the 11th hour. JT points out the contradictions of World War II in regards to Britain's policy. We went to war with Germany in 1939 because she invaded Poland, not Britain, mark you, nor any part of the British Empire, but Poland. Yet a short time later, Russia invaded Poland from the opposite side, but that was not a reason to go to war with her. On the contrary, Russia was soon to become our valued ally in war for 4 years. Russia was our ally up to May 1945. Then almost immediately afterwards, we were being told that Russia had aggressive designs on Western Europe, including Britain, and we had to arm ourselves against her. We were told during 1939 to 45 that, apart from fighting to defend the Poles and Czechs and others, we were fighting to defend our own empire, and this would certainly have been the only logical purpose for resisting Japan in the Far East. Yet as soon as the war was over, our leaders set about dismantling the very empire we were supposed to be defending. On the hypocrisy of the left, JT points out, the left in politics particularly applauded the process of imperial surrender, saying that it was wrong for one nation to rule others. Yet the left did not object to Russia still acting as an imperial power and ruling not just backward peoples, but European nations in many respects more advanced and civilized than itself. JT states these points of view were utterly incomprehensible to him as a young student of the political scene. After ourselves nearly bleeding to death in a world war, the British government was throwing away what we were supposed to be defending. Worse still, it was not only the left, but also the conservatives who were doing everything possible to bring it about, the very conservatives who had for decades proclaimed they were the party of patriotism and empire. JT points out the paradox of international communism supposedly being Britain's rival in a global power struggle, whilst at the same time the British government assisted the Soviets in taking large parts of Africa, including White Rhodesia and South Africa. Britain also regularly helped the Soviets by rescuing them from their food shortages. He asks, was this sheer insanity, or was it something else? JT states, studying events up to the 1950s, and without further evidence of numerous events since, he was driven to accept that the case for the theory of a conspiracy was a strong one. Indeed, before long, he came to the conclusion that it was overwhelming. For the reason stated, and what of conspiracy, then what was it, and who were the conspirators? JT states that he heard from older hands that all efforts to get books on the subject through normal distributive methods and stockboy libraries had failed. Some strange power of censorship existed throughout the book trade, whilst every conceivable form of filth and obscenity was to be seen regularly stocked on the shelves. He recalls he was once told by a chief buyer of a medium-sized book chain who, when offered supplies of this literature on a sale or return basis, replied that if he took up the offer, his firm would be out of business within less than a year. Put out of business? By whom? For what reason? JT says the writing of A.K. Chesterton were a sane source of information on these matters and was almost completely in accordance with his own picture of events. On the matter within the literature he studied was almost, though not wholly, unanimous. At the centre of the network stood a group of Jews, not all Jews, not even most Jews, but the most powerful and influential sections of Jewry, comprising its leaders in politics, business, in journalism, and in the cultural and intellectual world. The idea inspiring the majority of these people was Zionism. Not just Zionism aimed at setting up a Jewish national home in what was once Palestine, but a greater Zionism, directed to bringing all the world's nations and resources under control of Jewry and giving that race effective world leadership. JT then talks about mass media, which written in 1986 is outdated in the internet age. It does underline the power we now have, which was unimaginable just 25 years ago. JT continues, it was only after becoming properly conscious of these powers at work that he was able to see in full perspective the nature of Hitler's revolution in Germany and the campaign of hatred and venom whipped up against him by the press in Britain during that period. Previously, he had seen the anti-German policy of the British political establishment of the 1930s as wrong-headed from the British point of view, as he had also, needless to say, seen that involvement against Germany in World War II. Now, he states, he began to understand that something much more than mere wrong-headedness had promoted these policies. Forces had been at work that were determined to smash Hitler, quite irrespective of whether it was in the British interest to go to war with him. Why? JT takes a look at the film industry, both British and American. Just how many war films have we seen highlighting the crimes of Russia under Stalin, compared with the thousands dealing with crimes attributed to Germany almost every evening on British TV? There is a war film, and sometimes two or three, showing the German Nazis up as brutes, sadists, and murderers. Yet rare are the films attacking the Soviets in the same way, or Castro, or Pol Pot, or Mao Tse-tung, or the church-burning priests killing Republicans of pre-Franco Spain. And perhaps most pertinent of all, how many films have we been allowed to see exposing the atrocities of the Israel terror groups operating in Palestine at the time of the partition shortly after the war? JT attributes the highly selective venom and atrocity propaganda to two causes. One, that Hitler's regime in Germany was hostile to Jewish interests while other regimes were not. And two, that the motion picture industry is almost wholly Jewish-owned and controlled, a fact which not even the Jews themselves or their most ardent friends and admirers would deny. In Mein Kampf, JT comments, sweeping aside objections to style and phraseology and concentrating on the real arguments, I was bound to admit to myself that I was reading about in the pre-Hitler German context corresponded almost uncannily with what I had witnessed at first hand and even personally experienced in the contemporary British context. These findings do not become invalidated by later crimes against the Jews, whether real or merely the creation of anti-German propaganda. Right now, there is a raging controversy of global dimensions in which the whole Hitler period in Germany is being newly evaluated by a thorough re-examining of the evidence, a process best known as historical revisionism. Among other studies related to the same question, JT learned that advertising boycotts were the standard Jewish practice for maintaining press control. This method, JT states, was used in the 1930s to gag the Rothermere press, which beforehand had advocated a policy of peace and friendship towards Hitler's Germany. Likewise, it has been used in more recent times to bring into line any newspapers which dared to speak too strongly of Jewish power in Britain or criticise too scathingly the actions of the State of Israel. The power capable of arranging this kind of advertising boycott is known to all newspaper owners, and such knowledge is quite sufficient to keep the press in line without such a boycott actually having to be put into practice. It must also be remembered that a direct boycott of a paper is not the only means that Jewish interests have of putting pressure upon it. It is also quite possible for a business boycott to be organised against non-Jewish businesses which place adverts with such a paper, with exactly the same effect. Just such a case came to attention in 1994. A quick note here, although The 11th Hour was written in 1986 while John Tyndall was in prison, I am reading from the third edition, which was republished and updated in 1998. A Japanese magazine called Marco Polo dared to print an article challenging the story that Jews were deliberately exterminated in Hitler's Germany, a piece of the historical revisionism to which he referred earlier. Immediately, an advertising boycott was organised. Leading the boycott were the German car makers Volkswagen and the French luxury goods manufacturers Cartier. These are not Jewish companies, but were persuaded to withdraw their advertising contracts from Marco Polo by heavy Jewish pressure. Jewish business was not able to intimidate Marco Polo directly because the magazine had very little, if any, Jewish advertising. But he was able to intimidate Volkswagen and Cartier, and through them indirectly got at Marco Polo. Shortly afterwards, the magazine closed down. A story fabricated by anti-Semites, JT asks? Actually, it appeared in the London Jewish Chronicle of the 10th of February 1995. Look it up if you disbelieve me, he challenges. JT then returns to Mein Kampf and says how he was struck by the way Hitler had expressed he wanted peace with Britain. Just two facts about Hitler's Germany are relevant here, JT says. Firstly, that it represented no threat at all to Britain and her interests. Secondly, that it most certainly did represent a threat to Jewish interests, the interests at least of that section of Jewry holding decisive power over Jewish policy. The world Jewish leadership, therefore, had every cause to want to bring Hitler down. Great Britain had none. And yet, within 7 years of Hitler's assumption to power in Germany, Britain declared war on him. Let us ask ourselves a question. Was it the British interests or the Jewish interests that was the decisive factor shaping British policy during this period? The answer to this question scarcely needs spelling out. Goes along with many other answers to many other questions, to substantiate the view that there have been powerful forces, not evident to the public eye, that have shaped the course of British politics during the 20th century, and in a direction diametrically opposed to our own national good. There is abundant evidence that within these forces, certain Jewish elements play a powerful role, although this does not mean that such Jewish elements are the only ones present. On a conspiracy theory, JT goes on, the forces central to it as their objective, the destruction of the world's nation-states and the setting up of an international order, eventually to become a world government. Can this be proven? JT asks. In terms that would satisfy a court of law beyond all reasonable doubt, perhaps not at this stage. But what scarcely needs proving, because the evidence is so overwhelming, and therefore all to see, is that internationalism has become the dominating idea and policy of the modern age, particularly in Britain, where it rules the thinking of all the established political parties, and indeed also the mass media. Another fact which JT is in no doubt, as a result of having given close study to the political scene for more than 40 years, is that leading Jews are to be found, almost always, on the side of the internationalist causes that have dominated British politics during this time. It is not denied, even by the Jews themselves, that Jewish activists form the chief cadres of those subversive forces that brought about the revolution in Russia in 1917, as well as the short-lived Red Revolutions in Hungary and Bavaria, almost immediately following, and that communist doctrine beginning with Karl Marx and Ferdinand Lassalle probably owes more to Jewish intellectuals than to any others. Bearing in mind that communism has for many years been an essential prong of the worldwide drive to internationalism, we can say that certain Jews have, though this movement, made an enormous contribution to the internationalist cause and to those trends making the destruction of nations. The same Jewish muscle was to be seen in the setting up of the first Soviet state in Russia in 1917, was likewise revealed in the pressures that were applied at exactly the same time in history to induce the British and US governments to sponsor the setting up of the State of Israel. It is no secret that the support by Britain of the Balfour Declaration in favour of this Jewish national home was the major factor in bringing America into World War I. As in return for this, British pledged the powerful Jews in the United States, exerted all the influence they could on the American president, Woodrow Wilson, to persuade him and the Congress to opt for war. JT then describes how Jewry used the same kind of influence and power in the 1930s to steer Britain towards a war with Hitler's Germany. A short time later, Jewry in America, this time putting pressure on President Roosevelt, again were a major factor in bringing the United States into the same war. Today it is well known that the Jewish lobby in that same country is able practically to determine America's Middle Eastern policy by the fact that it can mobilize sufficient muscle at every presidential election to be able to determine which candidate wins. JT then illustrates the Jewish hypocrisy regarding racial matters, his experience as a campaigner against the multiracial idea in Britain and in favour of the retention of his country's centuries-old tradition of racial homogeneity, had brought home to him beyond any doubt the fact that Jews are to be found in the forefront of opposition to British racial self-preservation. Just a brief fist perusal through a few issues of their main organ, the Jewish Chronicle, will bear this out, he says. Yet in the same paper, one will find regularly expressed the fears of Jews against assimilation of their own kind into other races and their opposition to intermarriage with Gentiles. People aware of this paradox in Jewish thinking are forced inevitably to the question, is it the policy of Jewry to regard multiracialism as a commodity essentially for export, as something to encourage in non-Jewish peoples but never to practice amongst Jewry itself? And if so, why is there this inconsistency if it is not for the reason that multiracialism is seen as a method of weakening other races, while Jewry, by adherence to the very opposite policy, strengthens itself? Exactly the same kind of paradox can be seen in the fact that Jews will be found ceaselessly championing internationalist causes all over the world and denigrating nationalism as out of date and even evil, while in Israel what holds the whole state together is the most intense nationalism to be found anywhere on earth. Considering all this, JT proposes, might it not reasonably be argued that the theory of a Jewish conspiracy must be one of sufficient public interest for it to be subjected to a thorough public inquiry, to an even-sided public debate in which someone is permitted to speak for those many people of historical importance who might be classed as anti-Semites, in quotes, from Martin Luther to Hitler, from Shakespeare to Bloch and G.K. Chesterton, from Richard Wagner to Henry Ford. It would appear that those who are always raising the anti-Semitic bogey want it both ways. They want to ensure that the subject is never kept out of the spotlight, but they want to ensure equally that two points of view on it are never presented. Cast your eyes about the historical section of any large bookshop, and you are almost certain to see an ample selection of books dealing with the sufferings of the Jews, including, of course, books about World War II and about life under National Socialism in Germany. Same experience in a public library. Yet ask for any book putting forth the view of these accused of anti-Semitism, and you will be told that such books are not in stock. JT then talks of how people tried donating such material to libraries without success. He also talks of his own difficulty in being able to find such books and the total one-sidedness of the media. I'll skip some of this as I believe it is not the case so much nowadays. Although YouTube videos on the subject of Jewry and Holocaust revisionism are often took down, they go back up just as quickly. Just as Amazon are under pressure to stop selling said material, if they do, there are other outlets online where such books can be purchased. Although I can't say what John Tyndall's opinion would be on this subject if he were alive today, I believe he would have agreed. The Jews can get some websites closed down or videos deleted. This is like plugging a bursting dam with fingers and toes, in my opinion. I don't personally share the view that we are being allowed to write and post videos online to let off steam, in quotes. I believe they know that trying to silence the internet is impossible. That is their predicament, and we should use the advantage we now have fully, as we have been. Now, I'm going to leave it there for this week, because the rest of the chapter, as I alluded to, is a little bit out of date in an internet age. The next chapter is on the left, and it should be very detailed, so hopefully I can do more summarising and make more notes for next week. But for now, I'd like to play out with a video by a speech of Peter Rushton, which was at the John Tyndall Memorial meeting about a month ago. Peter Rushton is a long-time white nationalist and was a friend and comrade of John Tyndall. You can search him online. He is quite intellectual, but he's also got that kind of street activism kind of spirit. So he's an all-rounder, you could say. Now, I saw him today because I went to the Support the Political Prisoners of Golden Dawn demo in London, outside the Greek embassy, and Peter Rushton gave a speech there. Once that is up on YouTube, I shall post it in the comments section on the White Network to this post, so that should be in the next couple of days. So I'll play out with his speech now.
For being here today to honour JT's memory at this event, which, as several speakers have mentioned, represents the broad church of nationalism, of British nationalism. Now, ever since JT's death in 2005, there have been many occasions when many of us have had cause to wonder, you know, what would JT be writing in about this in Spearhead, about some particular national or international event that comes along? And as one speaker has already touched on today, I think there are this last month and in the year to come, there are two significant anniversaries that in different ways encapsulate what this movement faces. One of those anniversaries, 1914, comes up next year. It's the centenary of the First World War, commemorates the root of our national disaster. The other anniversary, by contrast, that's just passed a week or two ago, the 20th anniversary of Derek Beacon's victory in the East End, is more positively was the start of our fight back in very difficult circumstances. Again, in circumstances where many people might well have said the British people are finished, the white people of Europe are finished, and yet write in the heart of one of the darkest areas of Europe in every sense, the fight back began. So today I'll be touching on different aspects of those two anniversaries, one of them a disaster, one of them potentially the fight back. Now, looking at 1914 first, our typically fatuous Prime Minister, David Cameron, has recently promised that next year we'll see what he called a truly national commemoration. As he put it, that like the Diamond Jubilee celebrations this year, says something about who we are as a people. Can't you just see it already, the sort of things that he and the admin will have in mind? Won't be much British about it, will there?
No.
It'll be all, well, quite, except the people that we're supposed to be remembering will be British. But many of the people pushed to the front in the commemorations, just like the type of Britain that we see in every advert that we see on the television nowadays, every advert that we see in a magazine, every soap opera, every ideal couple that's promoted as the ideal type of Britain or the ideal type of European. There won't be much British about them. Not that would have been recognised by those who died in 1914-18 anyway. Because David Cameron, of course, neither knows nor cares anything about the British people. And his idea that 1914, the first of the two great 20th century disasters for the British and for our fellow Europeans, as Richard mentioned earlier, the idea that this should be celebrated as some sort of great national jubilee, some great jamboree on the streets, the bunting and flag waving and celebrations, that idea could scarcely be more offensive or inappropriate. Yet, in one sense, our Prime Minister, despite himself, was perhaps more accurate than he realised. Because 1914 and the 4 years that followed does tell us something about who we are as a people. Celebrations next year might not. 1914 itself and a serious examination of it does help create who we are today, and not least it did that by helping to create the type of bastardised political leadership that we have today through the culture of lies that's grown up in our political life since 1914. And for that culture of lies, we're indebted of all people to a chap who was a Labour MP between the wars, although he came from a very wealthy and influential family and included Napoleonic War generals, and that was Arthur Ponsonby, a Labour MP between the wars, who wrote a pioneering expose of political propaganda lies and war propaganda lies way back in 1928 with the highly appropriate title, Falsehood in Wartime. He wrote that, of course, for another anniversary, the 10th anniversary of the end of that war. And that makes it all the more daring, what he dared to say about propaganda lies, and the way in which what he had to say chimed with popular opinion at the time and was very influential. He said, in the introduction to that book, falsehood is a recognised and extremely useful weapon in warfare, and every country uses it, quite deliberately, to deceive its own people, to attract neutrals and to mislead the enemy. The ignorant and innocent masses in each country are unaware at the time that they are being misled, and when it's all over, only here and there are the falsehoods discovered and exposed. As it is all past history, and the desired effect has been produced by the stories and statements, no one troubles to investigate the facts and establish the truth. So wrote the Labour MP Arthur Ponsonby way back in 1928. And of course, victims of these falsehoods here in Lancashire included the Preston Powell's battalion, commemorated here in this building. more formally known as the 7th Service Battalion of the Loyal North Lancashire Regiment, the Preston Pals, and most famously, world famously, the Accrington Pals, from just one Lancashire town a few miles away from here. So, of course, tragically, these were called the Pals Battalions, of course, because the policy at the start of the war to get people to volunteer was to get groups of workmates, groups of neighbours, groups of people who went to the same church, groups of people who played in the same football and cricket teams, to join up together in some great surge of patriotic enthusiasm. With, of course, the tragic consequence that because they'd joined up together and gone into the same battalion together, when the inevitable happened, and massive casualties affected all in one moment neighbouring streets, groups of friends wiped out in an instant, relatives wiped out in an instant. So the Accrington Pals, most famously, just the 1st of July 1916 at the Somme. In the space of just 20 minutes from this small Lancashire town, the Accrington Pals lost 235 killed in 20 minutes and more than 350 wounded. Just a microcosm from here in Lancashire, just a few miles away of our great national disaster. The lying that surrounded that disaster didn't stop, of course, with the First World War, and neither did the physical and economic destruction, devastation, that brought the British Empire to its knees. And what ultimately sealed our betrayal was just after the Second World War. And for the first time, Britain became a country of mass immigration. Say for the first time. So we're lied to, of course, about that all the time. How many times do people say, do opinion formers say, do the respectable leaders of our political and media opinion say, oh, well, Britain's always, of course, been a nation of immigrants. Oh, yes, always been a nation of immigrants, the devils, you know.
Lies.
What an outrageous lie. Because, of course, it was really not until 1948 and the period around 1948 with the British Nationality Act, which gave British citizenship to vast swathes of the world, that that happened. But even at that moment, even at the moment, both just before and just after that act, the climate of respectable opinion of the great and the good, if you like, knew exactly what the consequence.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.